Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. Wanted to go over a video or tell you about a video I saw on YouTube. And most of you know I've been stuck in a hotel room here for quite some time with dealing with my trials and tribulations with my eyes. So I've been watching a lot of YouTube videos and reading a lot. And it just came up on my homepage where from one of these bigger channels that one of these 20-somethings have, that one of the finance kids, and it tells you how to invest. It kind of like a Graham Stephan type thing. And what he did is he went to a Tesla charging station. I think that's what they're called, where, you know, everyone's pulling up in their Tesla to charge their cars, their electric cars. And he did this in California, I think right outside of Los Angeles. And the whole title of the video was how I ask people, you know, how much money they make, what they do for a living, and how they were able to afford buying a Tesla, basically. And some of them had the Model S, so you figure that's called a $100,000 car. They buy it new. Or even the Model 3 or something, you know, with a lot of bells and whistles, I think is going to cost you 50 grand or so, maybe more. I don't know. But this is basically the gist of the video. So I thought, you know what, this is interesting because I have often wondered when I look around, not just at Teslas, but $100,000 cars in general. Like how do so many people... How do so many Americans drive around in $100,000 cars? I mean, shoot, you can trucks almost cost $100,000 now. You know, certain super fancy Expeditions or Lincolns or whatever they are, you know. And especially over $50,000. I mean, I remember when I was growing up, and I obviously there's been inflation. I get it, but not that much. I mean, when I was growing up, or in the market for buying my first car, call it in the late 90s, something like that. I mean, well, me, I was looking under $10,000 because I couldn't even afford that, to be honest with you. But you could get a really good solid car for 20 grand new. Now, I mean, not even close, I mean, 50, 60, 70. It's just absolutely staggering. And I've always wondered, you know, how are people doing this? There's no way that many people. And then this, and then right here in the chat, they say Model S costs more than 100K. So you can see what I'm saying. There's no way all of these people are producing that much or producing so much more than they were back in the 90s to where such a large percentage that is larger than back then are owning these cars that are incredibly expensive, 75, 100,000 plus. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to click on this video and check this out. I am actually curious what these people say. So the first person that he interviews is this guy, kind of longer hair, maybe 25, 26 years old, something like that. And the guy says, okay. And the first thing that struck me, and I think those of the people on the live stream right now that are in the Gen X? And then the baby boomers will really appreciate this. The first thing he starts off with, the very first question is, how much money do you make per year? Like, I was like, what? I mean, again, just, I guess it's a difference with, generations that back when I was growing up, you would have been punched in the face for asking that question. I mean, how much money do you make? Hey, how about you F yourself is the response you would have received. And that's best case scenario. But now the kids, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing. It's just something that is just dramatically different about the generations. You know, the kids, the 20-year-olds, the 25-year-olds, they're like, oh, yeah, I make 75 a year. Oh, yeah, I make this a year. Oh, yeah, I make this a year. And I'm just like, wow, is that, it just blows my mind. But anyway, that was the first thing I noticed. So the first guy that he interviews says, I can't call him. Oh yeah. He said he makes $250,000 a year. And he said he makes all that money doing marijuana meetups throughout California. So what he does is he sets up a meetup in, it's like a Tupperware party, but with weed. And so he makes basically $100,000 $250,000 a year doing these weed-based traveling Tupperware parties or dealing drugs. Yeah. Yeah, you could say that. And so I'm like, okay, hey, it's a free market, hats off to him. And if he's making money doing that, so be it. But then he goes into, okay, well, how did you pay for the Tesla or whatever like that? I can't remember what the exact question was. He's like, oh, I took all the money from the weed and I've just dumped it right into cryptocurrency. And then he says, then he takes all the profits from cryptocurrency and then just puts it into local real estate. And this is how he's been able to afford his grand lifestyle, including his whatever, $100,000 Tesla Model S. And then he goes on to say, well, something to the effect of, everyone knows that cryptocurrency is the future. And everyone knows that real estate always goes up in price. Duh. So I'm like, okay, there's some downside risk that this person has that I don't think he is cognizant of, to say the least. But then let's go into the next person. He interviewed probably four or five people. So the next person is a guy that, just look at my notes, he was maybe 35, something like that. And he bought his Tesla specifically to drive Uber, to be an Uber driver. So I'm like, okay, well, I mean, you guys know that without low interest rates, and what we've seen from the Federal Reserve and backstopping the market, bailing everyone out since 2008, there wouldn't be an Uber. I mean, you guys know that. There wouldn't be an Uber, wouldn't be a Tesla. You could say maybe the world wouldn't be as good today. Okay, that's debatable. But there's no way if the 10-year Treasury would have been at, let's say, 7% since 2008, there's no way there would be Tesla. There is no way there would be Uber. Why? Because people wouldn't have been willing to go that far out the risk curve. They wouldn't have been starving for yield or growth, right? So this is a direct result of the Fed keeping interest rates extremely low. That's the first point. The second point, and I still don't think Uber makes a profit. Maybe they do. I know they were just hemorrhaging money before the Cerveza sickness. I haven't checked on it lately. But what happens to Uber in a bear market that looks something like Japan in 1990, that goes down by 50% and just doesn't go back up for 10 years, where there is zero appetite for risk? Do they survive? I don't know. But anyway, so the guy goes on to say, I don't think this guy said how much he makes, but maybe the guy edited it out or something. But then he goes on to ask him, how he invests his earnings from driving Uber. He goes, oh, well, I just buy Tesla stock. Duh. So again, to say that this gentleman is short volatility, or I guess you could say he's short volatility. You could say that he is definitely short inflation, because if we get inflation, Fed raises rates, right? I mean, he might as well just buy 30-year treasuries. That's what he's doing by buying Tesla. It's like a leveraged 30-year treasury. Meaning that if interest rates go down, that's going to be a big tailwind for Tesla, all else being equal. But then he said that he has taken his profits from owning Tesla, which again probably wouldn't exist without the Fed keeping interest rates so low. And he's bought Bitcoin. And so, you know, he bought very early on Bitcoin. Again, more power to him, right? But you'll notice that maybe with the exception of the first gentleman, are these people producing more than they consume? Or are they consuming more than they produce? And if the answer is they're consuming more than they produce, the next question needs to be how? And where this leads you is to asset prices, asset bubbles to be more specific. And I'll keep going for there's like a couple more here. But what you'll notice is none of these people would be driving a Tesla right now, or let's just say a $100,000 car, if it weren't for asset prices, asset bubbles. So then you start to think, okay, well, if there were no asset bubbles, then there's no one driving a Tesla. If there's no one driving a Tesla, then Tesla goes out of business. If Tesla goes out of business, then they have to fire all their employees. If they have to fire all their employees, then how do those people buy goods and services? And if there's fewer people buying goods and services, what does that do to demand? And I know I'm just focusing on Tesla here, but insert any business into the equation. In fact, I would argue that even the revenue I receive from YouTube for these videos. You guys know that I don't do ads in the middle of my videos. I'd make a heck of a lot more money on YouTube. I'd probably double the amount of money that I make. But I just never, that's not my style. And I don't really, you know, I don't need an extra 10 grand a month or whatever it would be. So, but my point there is I'm in the same boat, right? I am, if it is my revenue or my income generated from Google a result of asset bubbles, most of it. I mean, say you're someone that's on the live stream right now and you work at a restaurant and you say, oh, George, well, my income isn't a derivative of asset bubbles. Really? Because if there were no asset bubbles, would you have any customers at your restaurant? You'd have a lot fewer. I can tell you that. So you do this thought experiment and it leads you to the obvious conclusion that if we had a Japan type situation in the United States over the next decade, where stock prices and real estate prices went down by 50, 60% and just stayed there, which quite frankly, they'd be at fair valuations if they went down by that much. What would happen to the US economy? It's a rhetorical question, but I wanted to plant that seed because that's my whole point of the video. Now let's go over a couple more of these examples or a couple more people that he interviewed. So the next person, or maybe the next person I wrote down here, was a salesperson. And he made, I think it was $7,500 a year or something like that. So what did he do? He sold construction supplies. So what happens to this guy's job if the real estate market goes down by 50%? Bye-bye. No job. So see, his direct income, I mean, a lot of us can think through it and say in an indirect way, our income would be negatively impacted if these asset bubbles deflated. This guy, his income is directly related to asset bubbles, i.e. housing, obviously. So, okay, his job is income. But then the question is, well, how were you able to afford this $100,000 Tesla? That's what he had, making 75 a year, 100 a year. It's like, oh, well, that was easy. I just day trade meme stocks. Made a killing last week on Bed Bath & Beyond. Okay, well, that's sustainable. See, you guys know this, but it must be said. In a healthy economy that is fundamentally sound, people are buying $100,000 cars because they are producing something. They're producing or helping to produce a good or service that, by the way, is sustainable, even at normalized interest rates. An economy that is built on demand being a direct derivative of wild speculation, asset bubbles in stocks and real estate, that isn't healthy. Not fundamentally sound and by no means is it sustainable. The next gal was owned a cafe. She was probably 26 years old, something like that. Looked like, you know, maybe she owned a little coffee shop or something. And I can't recall what she made. Maybe he edited it out. But okay, how do you afford the Tesla? What do you do? Oh, easy. Well, I've just at a very young age, you know, she's 26. So very young age, what was that, 3 years ago? She started investing in real estate. Duh. Don't you know, real estate always goes up. You can't lose with real estate. That's how she was able to afford her $100,000 Tesla.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macro economics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out of control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level.
See where I'm going with this? Pretty much every single person interviewed made a $100,000 purchase, let's just say, as a result of asset bubbles. Some of them, their job was directly tied to asset bubbles, and others, their income was just indirectly tied to asset bubbles. So again, the conclusion you have to come to. And Schiff, my good buddy, says this very well. It's the bubble economy. And that is a perfect way to describe what has happened to the United States since, call it the 1990s. And the question becomes, what does the U.S. economy look like if we go into Japan? Which there's people that can say that's impossible. Why? Why would that be impossible? Why would it be impossible for the U.S. stock market to go down by 50% and stay there for 10 years? Why would it be? And I can make a great argument why real estate could go down by 50% and stay there. Because at the end of the day, real estate is pretty much a derivative of incomes and interest rates. Simple. That's why inflation-adjusted home prices stayed the same in the United States for 100 years, from 1900 to call it 1997, home prices were flat when you adjust for inflation and size throughout the United States. Obviously, there are pockets that didn't apply to, but when you look at the macro picture, and again, this makes sense because home prices are a derivative of income and interest rates. So you got to have real incomes going up or interest rates going down. And if you got interest rates going up and you got real income going down, not good for real estate prices. And I have said since I started the George Gammon channel that we will at some time go back down to the historic norm based on incomes that we saw from 1900 to 1997. And you say, well, George, how far do prices have to come down to get to that level? 2012. Because 2012, we bottomed out very close to that long-term historic trend. Keep in mind, that doesn't necessarily mean that nominal prices go down. It just means that prices go down in real terms when you adjust for inflation, which is very easy. And let's just say that nominal prices go up by 5% per year over the next 7-8 years. And we have 10% annual rates of inflation. Real prices go right back down to where they were in 2012 because of that delta, that 5% delta between the 5% nominal increase and the 10% inflation rate. So most people think that the housing market can crash, and that means that nominal prices have to go down. No. No, the real estate market can crash up. And what I mean by that is going up in nominal terms and crashing in real terms. Look at the real estate market in Venezuela. That went up. That didn't go down, but it didn't go up near as fast as the currency was losing purchasing power. Therefore, in real terms, obviously the prices went down. So this is really something that I think is completely off the radar when it comes to the mainstream media and a lot of the talking heads out there, even on YouTube and FinTwit. It is just, they talk about the stock market going down by 50% and they just leave it at that. Oh, well, you know, we'll go through a bear market and like 74, we could go down by 50%. And, you know, that's just what we'd have to live with in the United States. And people would lose some money in the 401k and they'd get right back to work, have a little less demand. No. I'm like, dude, yeah, you don't get it. Because back in 74, half of aggregate demand wasn't dependent on asset prices. Believe it or not, demand was a result of productivity, where now demand is a result of productivity and asset bubbles. And I would argue the percentage skews towards asset bubbles, especially when you watch a video like that and every single person there bought a $100,000 Tesla specifically because asset bubbles we've had over the past 10 years. And you know what I always say, and it's so true, that the stock market is simply a mechanism set up to deliver maximum financial pain to the maximum amount of people. So usually what you see is when everyone is invested, every person is, so many times the Fed has come to the rescue. There's a Fed put. So keep buying the dip. And then you get a Japan type of scenario, because at the end of the day, quantitative easing, the Fed put, was simply the Wizard of Oz. It didn't exist. It's just in people's mind. So when people change their mind and they open that door and realize that the Wizard of Oz is just this little teeny guy that doesn't have any power at all, then they don't buy the dip. And everyone that bought the dip gets crushed. And don't you think that's a pretty darn good argument? No certainties, only probabilities. But let me phrase the question to you this way. Let's just assume for a moment you abolished the Fed tomorrow. No Fed, no more. So people then knew there was no Fed put or perceived Fed put. Where do you think the market would trade? Seriously, we ended the Fed tomorrow, meaning that the market knows there will never, ever, ever be a Fed put again. What does it do? How far down does it go? 20% in one day? 30, 40, 50? I would argue it could go down even further in one day. Now, obviously, this is probably not going to happen. But my point is, when the Fed put expires, and I think it has, just people don't know it yet, because I think the Fed put has gone to a government put. And in a world of mass inflation, assuming we stay there, and we may not, who knows, but in that type of environment, it's tough to have a government put. So if the Fed put has expired, I think your base case has to be the stock market goes down and stays down, because the psychological impact of the Fed put is the only reason it is where it is today. And the only reason the United States economy is not in a 1930s style depression. The only, and that doesn't have to be a deflationary depression, could be an inflationary depression. But the only reason 20, 30% of the population in LA or Phoenix or what have you is driving around in a $100,000 car, where back in the 90s, let's say, that would have been, I mean, even adjusted for inflation, that would have been, I mean, you guys remember that, what, maybe 5% at the most. I mean, it was just so rare to see a super expensive car like that. I mean, you'd see one like once every 2 weeks, even in the good part of town. Now you see 100 a day. And again, this is exclusively a result of the perceived Fed put. No Fed put, no stock market, no demand, no U.S. economy. And again, the reason I wanted to do a video on this is because I think this is completely off the radar for most of the talking heads on financial media or in financial media space. And even a lot of the people on FinTwit and YouTube channels, they think that, oh, well, the stock market and housing goes down by 50%. Well, that's going to suck, but no biggie. You know, the bad news, but it's a buying opportunity. They don't even think about it in terms of the economy. Like there's some sort of, they're stuck back in a world where the economy or the stock market is a derivative of the economy and not vice versa. They're stuck in that world, in that mindset. This is what I think is completely off their radar. And it's something I wanted to encourage all of you to think through. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your afternoon. As always, make sure that you stand up for freedom, for liberty, free market capitalism, and we'll see you in the next video.